Companies are given the opportunity to lobby on their behalf in regards to funding for the CUNY and SUNY system, making sure that we see some real TAP reform with the tuition assistance program. This is a great opportunity to ignite students to take part of the legislative process. And right here, I have some clipboards, and it would be great if you guys can sign up to allow me to speak into your classes. It will take less than 5 minutes so we could get as many students signed up as possible. We see on a national level that people are talking about higher education with free community colleges. And we also know that students here really benefit from additional funding and more financial aid. So we definitely want to see a strong showing of Queens College students going up to Albany to advocate on their behalf in relation to higher education affordability. So it'd be great if you can just fill out this quick sign up sheet. Pretty much, you just give me your name, the times that you teach, and your email address, and I'll follow up with you to let you know when I'll actually be in your room, come to your classes. And again, Higher Education Action Day is Thursday, February 26th. There will be a bus leaving here that's sponsored by the PSC, the Professional Staff Congress, around 8 o'clock, and lunch will be provided for the students, and it's completely free. So I definitely encourage all of you to, you know, really encourage your students to come out and making sure they're advocating on their behalf in relation to higher education affordability. Thank you. Thursday, February 26th, Higher Education Action Day. Thanks.
I'm Chris Labial, freshman sophomore rep and a member of the nominating committee. I'd just like to announce that Club Day is February 11th, next Wednesday. And this day is very important to us as senators because we'll be able to find future senators and keep the kids on campus like active. So if you could, anyone in your department, any students working there, anyone in your classes, any of your students, please let them know that Club Day is Wednesday next week, February 11th, and free hour in the ballroom. Thank you.
Good afternoon, members of the Senate. My name is Raj Maheshwari, current student body president. Just a quick recap on our finals week this past semester. We wanted to give a big thanks to the students and all the people that contributed towards making this finals week a success. We saw our most successful week. We did programming for students from midnight breakfast to opening the library up 24 hours. We had a puppy room, free Zumba and yoga classes, masseuses. We gave out plenty of free goodies, and we'd like to give a special recognition to the departments that made this happen. The Office of the President, the Vice President of Student Affairs, the Office of Student Life, Dining Services at the Student Union, Reprographics, and the Office of Public Safety. So a big thanks to everyone who made this happen. Thank you.
Okay, if there are no further announcements, I have two that I want to make. One, the Middle States accreditation process has started on campus. As a matter of fact, two out of the three co-chairs for Middle States are sitting right here in the back, Steve Schwartz, Chris Vickery, and I don't see Tony Gonzalez, but he's the third co-chair. Yesterday, the steering committee met, and we talked, and I'm on the steering committee, about some of the things that'll be happening starting 2015, 2016, and ending in 2017. One of the big things now that has started is there are 8 working groups. The co-chairs for each of those groups, a faculty member, administrative member, have been selected. But now the next step is more faculty. Each working group is looking for 6 to 7 members, counting the 2 co-chairs. So we're looking for more faculty. I'm sure the department chairs will be talking to the faculty about that. And we're also looking for students. So any student who's interested, this is the future of Queens College. We're looking at an accreditation process that'll take us the next 10 years. So any student who feels that they want to take part in that, and especially juniors and sophomores, seniors in the sense that you'll probably be leaving in June, and this will be a two-year process, so especially juniors and sophomores, let me know, let Phyllis and the Academic Senate office know, let any of the co-chairs that I just mentioned know, and we will work with you to get you on one of these 8 working groups. If there's any questions, I'll be happy to answer that, and I know the co-chairs could also answer anything that might come up with the Middle States accreditation process. Okay, if there's no questions on that, think about it. The other item, and this took a lot of us by surprise, the Board of Trustees at its last meeting accepted our charter amendment, and now adjuncts can run for the Senate. So what will happen during this nomination period, we will be putting out nomination materials asking adjuncts to self-nominate. They would be one position out of, right now there's 5 college-wide at-large positions. One of those would be reserved for an adjunct faculty member. And the questions come up, who is adjunct, whatever? Well, there's a case that someone, for instance, is a full-time HEO on campus, and they teach 1 or 2 classes. One class is enough. That person could then run as an adjunct. Again, if you have any questions, come to the Senate office. Myself, Phyllis, will try to answer them. One of the things, though, that will not be happening, when we have elections, and just to remind you, that's during the week of April 12th, even though adjuncts can nominate themselves and can be on the ballot, the fight for full adjunct representation is still going to go on, and it has to go on in this body, and eventually it would go on to the Board of Trustees again, and that would be giving adjuncts the vote. At this point, only full-time faculty will be able to vote for the adjuncts that have self-nominated. So you'll say, well, it's a half a victory or a shallow victory. I think it's getting where we have to go. It's a one step at a time process, and perhaps by 2016, adjuncts will be able to run, which they are already this year, 2015, and be able to vote for themselves. Okay. And let me just say, I think we had a special rabbi at the board meeting that helped push that on to the January agenda, and I won't say who it was. Okay, any more announcements, reports? Then I have the pleasure of announcing today's guest speaker, Ava Fernandez. She is the Assistant Vice Provost at Queens College, the Executive Director of the Center for Teaching and Learning, Associate Professor in the Linguistics and Communication Disorders Department, and also Doctoral Faculty in Linguistics, Hispanic and Luso-Brazilian Literature and Languages, and Speech and Language Hearing at the CUNY Grad Center. She has a bachelor's degree from NYU and a master's and a PhD from the CUNY Grad Center. Her work here at Queens College includes supporting and advocating for faculty use of instructional technology, providing centralized support for adjunct faculty, supervising experiential education programs, and bringing information about teaching and learning to the campus and incorporating these into assessment activities. And I think that's where Ava's going to focus today, a lot on the assessment activities that we have talked about in the past, and I'm sure we'll continue to talk about.
Manny, thank you so much. I'm so glad that I gave you a longish thing to say so that I could get down the very long stairs. instead of, thank you. Okay, that's all right. They're actually high. They should be okay. So I apologize for using my cell phone. I'm not checking Twitter. These are my notes. I couldn't get my iPad to work. So thank you again, Professor Sanudo. Thank you, Senators. for giving me the opportunity to talk to you today. All that stuff that Professor Sanudo just said about me doesn't really explain my connection to the topic that I'm talking to you about. So let me start with that. So as a professor at Queens College, I've been evaluated by students. I've been part of the teaching evaluation process for now going on 15 years. So that's one connection. The other connection is that in fall 2008, when the teaching evaluations went online, I was asked to serve as a faculty advisor to the process that basically then took several semesters to put in place a new system. And ever since, I've been involved with the online teaching evaluations, either as a faculty advisor or through my role as teaching center director. I'm an ex officio member of the Senate committee that assesses, that oversees the evaluations. That's the Teaching Excellence and Evaluations Committee. And I should be clear that what I say today isn't on behalf of the committee, but I don't think that the committee will disagree with what I say. And in fact, several of the members of the committee know what I'm going to say and gave me feedback and really helped. So students' evaluations of faculty are of faculty and courses are actually mandated by the CUNY Board of Trustees. The policy specifies that reappointment, tenure, or promotion recommendations for faculty need to include student evaluations. The policy also specifies that this process is in the hands of the governance plan that's in effect at each college, and that, of course, is you, the Senate, through the Teaching Excellence Committee that I mentioned. In truth, though, student evaluations of teaching are used for much more than just reappointing and tenuring and promoting faculty. For one, faculty use their evaluations to improve their teaching, and I'm sure every professor in this room has a story about how something that some student or a group of students said in a teaching evaluation environment has led to a better, to a redesigned lesson, to a re-envisioned learning environment. Also, in systems like ours, where evaluations are made available publicly, students can use these evaluations to make decisions about which courses you take. So at Queens, we've been publishing teaching evaluations data on the internet for free in the open ever since I've been here. And I think it's great that we choose to be transparent, especially at a time when more and more colleges are choosing to go and put their evaluations behind passwords, the data, that is. Let's not forget one more role, and this I promised the assessment folks sitting in the back that I would say this, that there's an additional role that evaluations play in studying the effectiveness of our curriculum. Through assessment activities, we're evaluating not instructors and not courses, but we can evaluate the curriculum, the institution. So how well are we educating our students? How well are we meeting that mission, as we say in our mission statement, of preparing students to become leading citizens of an increasingly global society? How rigorous is our education in the liberal arts? How well are we producing students that learn to think critically, address complex problems, explore various cultures, and use effectively the full array of available technologies and information resources? That's language lifted straight from our mission statement. And that's what institutional assessment is supposedly geared up to do. And we think that teaching evaluations can help us make some good progress in answering all of those institutional assessment questions. But now, this is all easier said than done. Many discussions that I've been a part of on the topic of teaching evaluations, rather than talking about what we can do with the data, will revolve around concerns like those that you see on the slide. Concerns that sometimes devolve into conversations about how, you know, these times, they're just not getting any better. This is, by the way, I'm not listing on the slide any of the kinds of things that students might have running through their minds. Like when you're asked to fill out an evaluation, what am I to get out of this? I really don't have time for it. Does anyone look at the data? I don't know, you can probably make that list better than I can, right? Because I'm not in your heads when you're filling out these evaluations. Now this list, I should tell you where it comes from. It comes from a paper whose title you can't see. Let's just say, okay, there we go. But it's a paper that's actually a nice meta-analysis of a large, set of data on how teaching evaluations work. And the paper actually doesn't call these concerns, but rather misconceptions, and then goes on to kind of debunk all of these and and explain how basically there are important trends that we might want to take into consideration, scholars that we are, in our use of these evaluations. So that's really why I'm here. I'd like to talk to you about what it might be that we would do if we wanted to use the evaluations data that we actually have based on the national trends, so that we could formulate improvements on the process of collecting and disseminating the data that are based on real empirical evidence. We're all, after all, scholars. This is a college. So I think that's a sensible thing to go and do. Now, I propose then that we should, we might consider formulating a study group that would actually do this and look at whether evaluations are reliable and valid forms of doing all of those, if the data is going to allow us to do the lofty things that I said at the very beginning. Now, I should point out that we have an excellent institutional data set. We have summary values by section for semesters dating back to spring 2001, which is data on over 52,000 sections, representing about 1 million acts of evaluation by Queens College students. Every time I think of this, I get really excited because I think, I mean, rate your professor, eat your heart out. We've got better stuff than they do. We really should be doing good stuff with it. So now, let's talk a little bit. I basically want to talk about how an evaluations data set might be reliable. I won't say all that much about validity today. And I want to show you some of examples of the kinds of explorations of the data that we've been doing at Queens. If my phone will let me do this. Let's talk about reliability first. Sorry, give me one quick second. Right, excuse me. This shouldn't have happened, sorry. So when people talk about reliability in data sets, they are interested in things like consistency, stability, and generalizability. Consistency has to do with agreement between people within a class. And the studies that have looked at this say that evaluated sections that have more than 10 data points in each, so more than 10 students evaluating, for those, the standard deviations and the standard errors are smaller and the means that you get are more stable. So perhaps this is one thing that we take from the literature that we begin to adopt in our interpreting teaching evaluations. Look at how many responses you have in a given data set and use that to determine whether that's a reliable number. Stability is another thing that folks who talk about this stuff discuss, and this has to do with agreement between raters over time. So we know that the data set for Queens College is super stable, and let me show you one example. I guess you can kind of see this. This is for all of those semesters listed on the right side. These are the mean difficulty ratings by department. So each dot on that graph represents one department's mean on that scale of difficulty that goes from one on the bottom to five on the top. The higher you are, the more difficult students rate that class to be, all right? And these are ordered basically from hardest ratings to easiest ratings. And I guess in that respect, I mean, notice how stable the data set is, right? It's really remarkable that departments over this long period of time vary by about a half a point at most from semester to semester over the course of 9 years. It's really remarkable. You could almost bet what philosophy is going to get next semester based on this graph. All right? The figure also shows us some differences between departments, okay? And I think you were all pointing those out to each other as I was talking, right? But the thing that's really remarkable too is that the differences are not that big. They're all clustered along the center of that scale, right? So that's something about the stability of the data set. Now, if you've studied statistics, of course, you know that data vary, and data vary a lot in the teaching evaluations too. Maybe we should be thinking about what variables we might be taking into consideration when looking at a data point. Do we need to control for certain things? Do we perhaps not need to control for others? So according to the literature, variables that in theory don't matter include idiosyncratic differences. Oh, thank you. Oh, thanks, that's fine. So idiosyncratic differences in instructors and students, like the ones that you see there. Now, variation in the time or the mode of administration of the survey also don't matter. But on this front, and in this front, we actually have yet another study that we've conducted at the college. Dean Savage looked at 45 sections of sociology where pencil and paper data were compared to online data, and what he found is exactly what the literature tells us is true, which is that mode of administration of the survey doesn't matter at all. The means were indistinguishable for those 45 sections, whether the students were rating the professors and the courses on paper or using an online instrument. Now, there are things that, according to the literature, vary in predictable ways, and these are the things that we might want to take good notice of. So, for example, variation by discipline. The graph that I showed you before showed you that basically chemistry, bio, and physics are hard, and BALA and urban studies and drama are easy. But so a 4 at Queen's College in difficulty is going to be remarkable, but it's going to be more remarkable for a drama class than for a chemistry class. And so this is something that we might want to sort of keep an eye on. Let me show you some additional explorations of variables that the literature says matter. One of them is class size, and I don't expect you to walk away and really understand this graph, and I'll share with you the where you can go and play around with these data later. So this is a graph that shows you class size on the horizontal axis. And I'm only showing you those little dots each represent one section during the fall 2014 semester. The axis on the vertical axis is that overall course question, which asks how would you rate this course overall as opposed to the instructor on a scale of 1 to 5, where 1 is worst and 5 is best. And what you can see is that the bigger the class, the lower the overall course rating is. So class size is a pretty robust, predictable effect. So again, if you get a 3.5 and you're a small class, it's perhaps not the same as getting a 3.5 and you're a big class. Course difficulty is something that the literature says affects how other aspects of the course are rated. And what this shows you is that same overall course variable that I in the previous graph. Difficulty plotted on the horizontal axis now. What you see is, again, a negative distribution where the more difficult the course is, so the more to the right it is, the lower its overall rating is. There's additional things that the literature says are going on. So in addition to discipline, class size, course difficulty, which I showed you, the literature reports effects of course level, instructor rank, instructor expressiveness, student motivation, expected grades. And those are things that we're beginning to explore in the data set. I don't have time to show you some of those, but that link will take you to a visualization of the stuff I showed you today where you can actually play around and see how the data kind of looks for your department or for semesters other than 4/2014. I'm almost done. In fact, maybe I'll just say a couple of things here about validity. So we haven't done much work on what I think would be the next step. So first, let's explore the reliability of the data set, right? But next, we should also be exploring the validity. Do these student evaluations actually map up with other things that we think are measures of student learning? And well, one thing would be grades. Another thing would be ratings of the instructor or the course by either administrators or colleagues or alumni. We run alumni surveys. We also do teaching observations. And by the way, you should notice that teaching observations are another one of these board-mandated components for demonstrating teaching effectiveness in reappointment and tenure and promotion decisions. We conduct teaching observations at the college very regularly, but we conduct these in rather uneven ways, and this is an aspect of our assessment of teaching that we might consider revisiting, that you could consider revisiting as a Senate, or you could charge the Teaching Excellence Committee to look at. Now, the point of me showing you all of this is that interpreting data like teaching evaluations is complicated. But you know, what else is new? Teaching and learning are complicated things. They're hard to measure. And as an institution, if we're going to use teaching, if we're going to use evaluations data in personnel decisions or to improve our teaching or to choose better courses or to do institutional assessment, we better do it in an informed and scholarly way. We've got the tools, let's use them. So if you're interested and if you have talents in data analysis, this is, sorry, I can't help it, but come and join our group, right? I invite you to join me and others who are already doing explorations of this marvelous data set. Let's form a study group. We have plenty of work to do on both the reliability and the validity fronts. And of course, ask us to come back and report on our progress, and we definitely will. We also have plenty of work to do as an institution to improve on the collecting and disseminating of the data. And I know that this body has discussed aspects of that very recently. Now, the Teaching Excellence Committee has a charge that the Senate should take a close look at, because the charge actually refers to administrative structures that have changed over the years and that are surely going to change again without perhaps the Senate's involvement. The charge also assumes restrictions and tools that are obsolete. So that's one thing that you might want to have a look at as a body. To see how we can make progress on that third bullet there. That's all I have to say, and I don't know if there's time for questions. Thank you. Often presentations with lots of data get no questions. It's kind of interesting. Yes, Alan. Senator Ludman, yes. Well, so the study that I mentioned earlier that used the same instrument as the college's instrument for sociology sections. I don't know off the top of my head if anybody has done those comparisons. My gut tells me that students in evaluating courses and professors are highly predictable. I mean, this is, you know, we see when we look at means, we see very little variation, right? But that's something that if a department has a data set that they'd like to compare to this one, you know, we welcome you to do it.
I don't know of any other similar studies at Queens College. They could be done, but you would need to use exactly the same question. You couldn't compare the results on different questions. That wouldn't make sense. I do know of one study in psychology at Brooklyn. A professor charged her class members to enter all the data from Rate My Professors with comparable course data, evaluating the same courses from the Brooklyn College instrument. The overall correlation was 0.7. So RMP's not all that bad.
Right, but we think our data set is more complete. We don't evaluate, well, any. Are there other questions?
Thank you. I just wanted to inquire a little more about your discussion up front and quoting from the mission statement, and how well, in the research that you've done, how well you feel the questions that we have really map into that mission statement. For example, I don't really know that we could say that they're a reflection of citizenry or, you know, working to serve for the common good.
So I couldn't have planted a better question, thank you. Because this is in fact something that that I think we should be really experimenting with. Our questions are rather old. They're very focused on the instructor and don't ask things like, how much time do you spend studying or reading and writing in this class, or do you do quantitative analysis, or do you use information technology in this class? Our questions become not all that close to addressing any of these civic engagedness issues that you brought up that are so very important in our mission statement, because they're in the first paragraph and we all think that they're important. Um, And the importance of a liberal arts education, yes. So that is absolutely something that would be wonderful to incorporate into the questionnaire. Now, I guess this goes back to the end of my remarks, where I said that, you know, this committee has a charge that's perhaps a little bit crippling in terms of allowing us to experiment with the kinds of questions that we need to be asking. So if every time that the committee wants to make a change to the questionnaire, it needs to come through a Senate process, then we are not going to make very quick progress in terms of identifying the right kinds of questions. Also, I think we need to recruit. Now, what's wonderful about Queen's College is that we've got expertise in almost anything. So we need to be recruiting the folks who have expertise in building questions like this that will try and get some sort of reflection of the kinds of things we're interested in asking. Thank you. So that's a really great point.
Hi.
Yes.
You mentioned teacher observations.
Yes.
And how you could use that the same way you use teacher evaluations in terms of tenure. What are the different, how do they differ, that kind of data? Which one weighs more by like the head of the department, like looking at this data?
Well, so I'm not sure that I'm the right person to answer this question, but okay. Of course there are two very different kinds of data, because for one, the generator of the data point in the student evaluations is a student, and the generator of the data point, if you want to call it a data point, for the observations is a peer. So usually a fellow faculty member will come and observe a professor during a class period. If the class is online, the observation is of the online environment. There's usually a write-up that follows from the observer, and that write-up is subsequently discussed by the observer and the observee. And that paper document goes into the observee's personnel file, and then is used by the committees, by the set of committees that make decisions on this kind of thing. And I certainly am not going to speak for either my departmental PMB or for the Committee of Seven on how they weigh these things. It's very complicated, for sure.
Also, you mentioned how the Teaching Excellence Committee could do things with this teaching observation.
Well, so this is something that we've been, that some of us in the Teaching Learning Center discuss all the time. I mean, do observers know the kinds of things to look for, or are they, could they get some guidance? Could there be more consistency between departments on how these things are done?
So,
I think this might be an interesting exercise for us to engage in as a college,
right,
so that we have, I guess, people getting better feedback as a result of these observations.
Right. And you mean like a sort of regulation that exists across all departments?
Yes.
In terms of what to look for and...
Yes, okay. Yes.
Wonderful idea.
Thank you. Well, let's work on it together. I don't know if you're a member of the Teaching Excellence Committee, but... Okay. Well, talk to the Teaching Excellence members. Thank you.
So I'm Natalia Holtzman, representative from biology. I just want to say thank you. That was really enlightening. I would love to have an opportunity to look at some of that data more. I saw that you did post a little link to it, but I also know that it would be helpful. Yeah, so is it through the Center for Teaching and Learning website? If we go there, we can navigate?
Yes, thank you. So if you go to the very top link, you will get to all of this stuff. As soon as I have internet access, I will post my presentation. My presentation is the link on the left. And the data that I presented today is the link on the right. You can go and play around with things like, you know, those means that we showed you before of course difficulty by department. Well, they actually change in interesting ways once you set up the visualization to only show you sections that have more than 10 respondents or sections that have more than 6 people enrolled in them. So I encourage you to play around with that so that you can learn a little bit about how deceptive means can be when the mean is not stable. Yeah.
Okay, I'm Erica Davis, Secretary of the Executive Committee. I just wanted to ask if that study group would be exclusive to faculty or be open to student members as well?
We don't discriminate at all. We'll take you if you're interested. We'll work with you, absolutely.
Great, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Chris Clausen, representative of the Math Department. You mentioned as one of the misconceptions that evaluations lead to grade inflation. Do you have any data that would compare the overall satisfaction with a given of a given course with the average grade in that course? And is there correlation?
So the last time I've seen some explorations of exactly that done by Dean Savage, we haven't done any recent ones, but it is certainly one of those goals that I have for the data group, to go ahead and take a big grades data set and merge it with the evaluations data set and see what happens, mm-hmm. right? And I think this is probably more than just a weekend project for someone like you. but I think we can do it. We've got the analytical tools to really go ahead and explore this stuff. Most importantly, because I think it can help us become better as an institution, you know, where we can identify where are our strengths, where are our weaknesses, and, you know, why are we all here?
Thank
Thanks.
You.
Can I add to that?
So in the literature, there is a debate about whether or not when you have a course that gives high grades, the students respond thankfully and give high evaluations because they received high grades. But there's another school of thought that has very strong representation in the literature, empirical representation, and that is, I'm a really good teacher, I really teach well, my students learn better, they get better grades, and they give good evaluations as a result. Now, separating out which of these two theories is right for the Queen's College data set would be a really worthwhile exercise. We know that there's a fair amount of variation in lots of classes. You can get people with give you a 2 and other people give you a 4. That does happen in about a third of the cases. And so there's work to be done here. This is one of the reasons I wanted to let the comments be read by everybody, because when you read the prose comments, you can tell if a person's just in there for the easy grade or if they're in there because this person is a really good teacher and I really learned a lot.
I thought nobody would bring up the comments question. Thank you, Dean.
Out of curiosity, in terms of correlation between courses that are being used to satisfy a general education requirement and courses that are not being used to satisfy a general education requirement, I see huge variation in my own evaluations in a course that satisfies a lab science requirement, and I'm curious to know if there's any data about that.
Well, so actually a quick thing. I mean, I debated whether to show you level effects. So this is that difficulty by course, overall course thing we saw before. This is 100 level courses, this is 200 level courses, and this is 300 level courses. In those orange bubbles are all the gen eds, and we haven't had a chance yet to separate the gen eds from the other 100 level courses. I think that's a really good question, and it's one that's really worth taking into account, especially when you are taking, say, a single data point for an instructor or a course that is in one of these categories that tends to be very low on the scales, for reasons that perhaps have nothing to do with the overall teaching effectiveness of this person. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Mark Hanson Cartwright from Music, and first I just want to say thank you. It was a very clear and informative presentation. I really have a comment, which I'm sure has been at the back of many faculty members' minds as this discussion goes on. And the comment is, we all know that there's a great difficulty getting the numbers of student respondents to be adequate for proper evaluation of faculty. I know that we haven't found the cure, but it seems to me not right that a student is entitled to a grade for a course, but a faculty member is not immediately entitled to 100% response from all the students. We have no mechanism that guarantees that at this point, and I think it's an injustice to the faculty that that mechanism isn't in place.
Right. So I think that we've been very focused on overall response rate, and what I tried to urge you to think about today was, rather than response rate, can you get a bare minimum there? So if you've got 10 respondents for a class, you're really in safe territory in terms of the mean, the average being okay. Now, I realize that you might be teaching small classes.
The difficulty is that in music, particularly for those like myself who teach the major, our sections typically are from 10 to 15 students.
Absolutely.
And so if
right.
you have a response rate of 30% in a class of 15, that's about 5 students. It's not adequate.
Right. So. Look, I mean, you know, 10 is, it's really hard to scale this down when you have sections that are so small. And in fact, one of the conversations that I've been, that the Teaching Excellence Committee has been having for a while is whether we should be evaluating very, very small sections of, say, 6 or 5 or 3 or 2 or 1.
Make the music classes larger.
Well, I don't know that I'd want to recommend that. but yeah, I agree with you. This is a really tricky thing, and I think we need to be careful with dictating what must happen in order for something to be taken as valid, right? I do know also that you know, over the course of putting these things online, we've gotten a little bit better, but we're not quite there yet in terms of getting the information out to students. I do know that the people who played the most important role in getting the rate up is instructors themselves. There are a number of ways that you can get those response rates up. You know, there are some suggestions there, and I certainly have others that we can talk about offline if you like. Yes, there's a question in the back. They can go to a computer lab, and their cell phones will also work quite well. So you can ask them to take out their cell phone at the end of the last class. Though I can see how that might be uncomfortable. In fact, I don't do that at all. I tell my students they should not be doing evaluations in my class. But thank you very much.
Wow, I like these penumbra lights. They make me look better. Oh, no. Okay. Okay, let's go to item number 5, committee reports, undergraduate curriculum committee.
To move the minutes of the December 11, 2014 Undergraduate Curriculum Committee meeting and ask for unanimous consent.
Any objections? Okay, but.
Nancy Fosberg, Arts and Humanities at Large. Okay, in 1C, it's quite long, but some of them make reference to a class that, okay, so at the toward the end of this section, on page 5, near the top of page 5, it says Arts 190 has replaced Arts 171. On the previous page, page 4, it says that it's changing from graphic design elective courses to design elective courses, and there's a list, but the list includes 171. So that should be changed to 190, I believe. I don't know if anyone from ART can correct me on that.
Yes, please come to the mic.
Catherine Weinstein, graphic design. Arts 171 would become a graphic design elective, but the requirement, the core class, is now 190. Does that make sense?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay.
Yeah. If there's no objections, we have unanimous consent. So moved. Okay. Next item, Graduate Curriculum Committee minutes. December 17th.
I ask that the Senate approve the Graduate Curriculum Committee minutes dated December 17th.
We ask for unanimous consent.
Unanimous consent.
Any objections? Okay, seeing none then. Minutes are approved. Nominating committee report.
Hi, I'm Sarah Wolf. I'm reporting for Marion Fish. With the exception, everybody has this in their packet. With the exception of the removal of Philip Tarantini, whose seat was filled, the committee is requesting unanimous consent for this set of nominees.
Okay, again, we're asking for unanimous consent, and the last person, Tarantini, Philip, has been withdrawn. Any objections? Seeing none, the motion passes. Okay, now we have an executive committee election. It's for a vacant faculty seat on the executive committee. Terry Quinn, who occupied that seat, has retired.
I'd like to nominate Jennifer Kyle from the Education and Community Programs Department to fill that seat.
Any further nominations? Okay, seeing none, then the secretary will cast one vote for Jennifer Kyle. Old business, none. New business. This is for the nominating committee. This is a student seat, arts and humanities. And again, this seat is nominations from the floor only. Do we have any nominations? No nominations. All right, seeing none.
Next What's that?
It'll be old business next time. Okay. All right. Well, then, seeing item 7A, old business for next time, is there a motion to adjourn?
No.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.